This message comes from NPR sponsor, Mattress Firm. Sleep hot. Mattress Firm's sleep experts can match you with a cooling mattress from the Tempur-Breeze collection from Tempur-Pedic, so you can experience measurably cooler sleep all night. Get matched at Mattress Firm's Memorial Day sale. Sleep at night.
Hey, y'all. You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Sam Sanders, and Happy New Year's Eve to everyone. This is officially our last It's Been a Minute episode of 2021. Can you believe it? So, before the year ends, I want to return to a conversation you may have missed in this podcast feed. It's from right before the Super Bowl. And if I'm being honest, I don't even remember at this point who won the game this year. But I do remember the conversation I had that week that really stuck with me. It was all about Super Bowl 1991. That was the year Whitney Houston sang the national anthem before the game began. I talked with Danielle Smith. She's the host of Black Girl Songbook. And we discussed how Whitney Houston captivated the entire nation with her rendition of the national anthem that year. And why it still matters a lot today. I love this conversation, and I cannot think of a better way to close out this year on this show. All right, enjoy.
What was the national mood then?
I mean, to be honest, the national mood was everybody was kind of shook.
That is Danielle Smith, and she is talking about the national mood in the run-up to the Super Bowl in January 1991.
It was a different time. I mean, besides the fact that there was no social media yet or anything like that, there hadn't been these huge terrorist events like the Twin Towers going down in Manhattan, the Boston Marathon. Those kind of things hadn't happened yet. We didn't really have a lot of familiarity with walking through metal detectors and things like that to go into ball games of any kind.
America had just entered the first Gulf War 10 days before. People were scared. And the game, Super Bowl 25, it became this visual symbol of America's emerging modern security state.
There was a lot of thought at that time that the Super Bowl was a soft target.
Oh, wow.
Because, you know, there would be so many people there. And I believe at that time there were 1,700 individual security personnel on site. It was one of the first times they put up barricades around a stadium.
In the midst of all of this, a nation at war, one of the greatest pop stars of all time delivered perhaps the greatest performance of the national anthem ever.
And now to honor America, especially the brave men and women serving our nation in the Persian Gulf and throughout the world, please join in the singing of our national anthem. The anthem will be followed
Whitney Houston. Whitney's rendition of the national anthem was a certified hit when it was released, and it helped soothe an entire nation on edge. In the aftermath of 9/11, Whitney's version of the national anthem became a hit again. It reached the top 20 on the Billboard charts and soothed America's soul once more. So, like I said, Danielle Smith, former Vibe editor-in-chief and host of the show Black Girl Songbook, she joined me to talk about all of this. Danielle also wrote the definitive oral history of Whitney's performance for ESPN. So there was no better person to help me make sense of why, 30 years later, this moment of Black history still says so much about race and patriotism and a whole lot more. Whitney Houston is, she is operating in this really rarefied air. In 91, you know, her and Michael Jackson were really the first true pop Black crossover stars of the MTV era. And she had been fighting through this kind of shiny, perfect image of pop stardom to be taken as seriously and have the same ubiquity as white pop stars. And so to see her in this moment of intense patriotism singing the national anthem, that is perhaps the ultimate crossover for a Black woman like her, no?
Yes, and I always think, one, I agree with everything you say there. And I also do think that crossover is a term that we all use without really saying exactly what it means.
Mm, say it.
It means to cross over, but no one says crossover from what to what, right?
Mm.
Back then, it meant because radio stations were segregated at that time, and Black stations played Black music, and pop/white stations played white music. One had to cross over from Blackness to whiteness to have the kind of opportunities for success, money, ticket sales, radio sales, all of those things that tie in to being a global superstar, to have those kind of opportunities. I always say that Whitney Houston didn't spend her career fighting for pop success. She used her career, she was fighting for pop equality.
Mm.
It's different.
Yeah.
It wasn't fair, frankly. The fact that MTV had to be pretty much forced into playing Michael Jackson's videos. Literally, other labels had to threaten to withhold their white pop stars from MTV so that MTV would play Michael Jackson's videos. And Whitney found herself in a very similar position. So yes, to see her there after seven consecutive number one pop hits, it was, and I always say, I didn't see it in real time. Mm. Did not see them. I was at work. I was working retail at the time in San Francisco, and they were like, it's Super Bowl Sunday. Do you want to come in? And I was like, does it pay time and a half? Because if it does, I'm on the train. So, but to see her, it was everywhere. They replayed it over and over and over and over again. It was on the radio almost immediately after she sang it, because the radio DJs literally taped it from the television broadcast and started playing
wow.
it. So then Arista Records actually put it out as a single, and the single went platinum. This is the power of Whitney Houston.
Coming up, breaking down Whitney's entire performance at that Super Bowl, beat by beat. Stay with us.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Discover. Here's a familiar situation. You have a question about your credit card. You call the number for help and can't get a hold of anyone. If only you had a Discover card. With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. A real person. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Homes.com. When you're home shopping as a parent, you have lots of questions about local schools. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by a dedicated in-house research team. It's also you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
On NPR's Throughline.
We cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt, because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
The Embedded Podcast brings you eye-opening reporting.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Immersive journalism.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Personal stories.
I was scared. Like, I can't protect you.
We are NPR's home for documentary storytelling. Find Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.
First, I want to talk about just the imagery of Whitney that night. You know, she is in the stadium. There's an entire orchestra behind her. There's military patrol all around, military jets in the air. But she is dressed down. She's wearing this white tracksuit. She's got a headband on. She is this dignified soccer mom, patriotic. Miss America to the T, even these little cross earrings that she wore. And I think just her look was perhaps almost in itself revolutionary. Her looking like that in that space. What was the look for you?
I couldn't believe when I saw it, I was like, that's what she wore? Is she at rehearsal? I was like, there's a lot of things that Whitney Houston was known for in her career. Showing up to stuff in a sweatsuit, right, in joggers and a zip-up jacket is not among them.
Yeah.
And she did, in fact, look like she might be going to choir rehearsal on any given Thursday night at her church in Newark.
Yes.
That's what it looked like. But that was the energy that was needed, because honestly, declaring war is a kind of insanity that it's very difficult for me to wrap my head around. But I do know this. It's not the kind of thing that you need to celebrate with, you know, diamonds and furs and heels. And it seems very much like that outfit that she wore was almost out of respect for the fact that a lot of people were pulling on uniforms and going to put their lives on the line.
Yeah.
And she sang it like that.
Listen, and I want to talk more about the singing. But I do got to say, I watched the video again last night, and I realized Whitney Houston, as America's soccer mom, in that white tracksuit, singing America's song at the start of a war, it was this image of a black woman as the ultimate symbol of patriotism. And she was perhaps in that moment the most American thing you'd ever seen. And that's a big deal for a black woman to be that.
It's a massive deal for a black woman to be that and to be visible as that. It wasn't like she was just chosen because, oh my God, there's this black woman and she has an amazing voice and we should like pull her out. You know, frankly, there's a black woman with an amazing voice, you know, a lot of places around the recording industry. Mm-hmm. But the thing that was going on with Whitney Houston is they knew that she would do the kind of job she would do for reasons that most people know, that most people would do a good job at what they're hired for. It's the experience and the success that they've had thus far. And when you're the kind of person who has 7 consecutive number one pop hits, you have to realize when you have a number one pop hit, that means everybody pretty much knows who you are in the United States of America. So then you're going to times that by 7 consecutive.
We can't even, in this era of pop music, I don't think we can understand how big of a deal that is. It's a big deal.
No, it's so, she was selling millions and millions of records. She was never, never not on the radio.
Man.
Believe me, the National Football League knew that they were hiring a person who had the experience of moving masses of people.
Yeah. You know, when you break it down, she slowed it down. She took it from a waltz to a 4-4. So she went from 3-4 to 4-4, changed the time signature, made it more poppy, made it slower. And her delivery is pretty straightforward. There's not too many riffs, not too many runs. She's singing the song. She's belting it, but she's just singing the song pretty straightforward. And it's incredibly restrained. Why does that work in that moment when we're used to right now pop stars just really doing the most?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, I really feel like the reason that it worked the most is because where most people are nervous, Whitney is the most calm. The spaces in the song where the notes are most difficult to get to or hold, Whitney is actually most at ease.
Yeah. And we should point out here, you know, everyone that does these kind of performances, they do it pre-tape because you just can't sing live in a big stadium. It's impossible. But she did her pre-tape in just one take.
She did, because this is the thing. It's, I love a good run. Whitney could do a run times a million, but she used them very strategically, and she chose not to use them here. One, I think it's because runs are difficult to sing along with, and I think she wanted to make a version of this, of our national anthem, that was very easy to sing along to, and it was. And the other thing is she turned it into kind of a bluesy ballad, and that is what Whitney Houston did for a living.
Yeah. Well, and there's a certain presentation of race that comes when you make the national anthem the blues, when you make it soul, when you take it from 3-4 to 4-4. And it is, in my mind, this subversive blackness that I appreciated her doing in that moment.
Yes, I mean, it is subversive, but it's also very, very upfront and topmost. Because the thing is, the music that most of America loves, honestly, is based in black blues, rhythm and blues, jazz, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not a reach to imagine that a whole bunch of people would like to hear something that sounds a bit bluesy and a bit like a Whitney ballad, because that's what people like in general in this country.
Yeah.
When you go into the history of music in this country, which is complex, criminal, and bizarre,
yeah.
What you see yeah. over and over again, and this is a story that I know people are familiar with, but it deserves to be said a lot, which is it's the music of Black blues men and women that was stolen or replicated by white artists, so with the idea of making it more quote-unquote palatable for broader white audiences. But so when you see somebody like Whitney up there just like translating like what is a very solemn and sad moment, a very bluesy moment for the USA, right? It's wildly appropriate. And that's what it is. I don't think her moment was magical. People were like, oh, it was magic. And I'm like, I don't know if it was magic. I think it was the right choice. I think Whitney was the right person. I think she put to work in to put herself in place to do that. And she was where she was supposed to be because she placed herself in the position to be available to that moment.
Coming up, Danielle tells me her biggest takeaway about that Super Bowl and Whitney's performance 30 years later.
In any great story, there's a moment that sparks your curiosity, tells you there is more to uncover.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
That's where Embedded comes in. We are NPR's home for documentary journalism, immersive and intimate stories.
I was stone cold speechless.
Nothing will ever, 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 ever be the same here.
Find Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.
Climate change fuels hurricanes.
China promises to stop.
The big lie persists.
Butterflies have hearts.
Singers die.
Plumbers win.
Nurses persevere.
Your world speaks.
We listen.
NPR podcasts.
More voices, all ears.
Find NPR wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Why did Cola Scola write a bonkers, extremely fictionalized play about Mary Todd Lincoln?
Well, you know, it was 2020 and we were all so isolated. I just started doing research. But the truth is, I just thought of it.
We'll talk about that and more on Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Do you wish stories could unfold over 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? You tired of doom scrolling, trying to find humanity? Or maybe a deeper understanding of why the world is the way it is? Listen to Embedded, NPR's original documentary series. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
What for you is your biggest takeaway from Whitney's performance of the national anthem at the Super Bowl in 91, 30 years later? I mean, it is a meditation on lots of things, race and patriotism and the importance of popular music and the monoculture. But looking back, what stays with you the most?
If you want to know the honest truth for me, what stays with me the most is the fact that she would be dead so early. I think about all that we could be experiencing from her right now. I think about the model that she would present for younger singers, for young Black women, and really for women of all races.
Yeah,
she's such a picture in that moment of preparation and grace. And it's one that I always, my favorite part of her performance, it always makes me a little bit emotional to speak about Whitney in the past tense, to be honest. She's been my favorite since I was a teenager. But when she sings the word free, right, you have to go up really high for that note. And so many people falter at that space. They shorten it. It kind of goes thin at the top of their voices. Whitney not only sings it strong and big and rich and lush. All the way through as she's building up to the high note. But just to let you know how dope she is, she adds like a 2 or 3 note flourish.
She hits the five, and she's like,
yes.
And then she goes all the way up to the top, and you're like, how'd you do that?
Like, who's doing that? She did it because she could. And then that was a moment when she didn't care if everybody could sing along with her. That was the moment when she's like, I'm giving y'all me right here. Mm-hmm. It just reminds me as I walk through life. Yes, we're all here, frankly, to me, in my opinion, to be in service to each other for a better world, right? That's our best case scenario on this planet Earth. But every once in a while, you have to remind people who you are. Uh-huh. And that's when she did it.
Yeah.
What stays with it for me is the imagery of Whitney in this pitch-perfect, transcendent pop superstardom, and realizing when you follow the rest of her career in life, it was maybe too much pressure to be that perfect. And I think a lot about what we as a culture and as a country asked of a star like her. And it just feels like no one can be that perfect forever. And she had so much pressure on her.
She had so much pressure on her. In addition to the pressure that she put on herself. You know, I tell people I interviewed Whitney in 1995. I am blessed to have spent like 4 hours with her at her home in New Jersey at the time. And yes, it was a great evening. And I just thought to myself so many times over the course of that evening, you never look like this. In public, you never look like this physically. Your personality never reads like this when you're in public. It was very easy for me to see how much of a performance her life was, even when she wasn't on stage, but just when she was moving through the world of the music business. And I don't understand how she did it. I don't understand how she did it from such a young age and for so long. And it's, I do believe, and I agree with you, when you say, you know, it was such a weight. I think it's part of what caused her to die in the way that she died.
Yeah.
You know, she died during Grammy week. It's like, it's one of the most heartbreaking stories, honestly, in the history of pop. And the thing that makes it wild to me is that when you talk about sort of the unfairness of how black women are viewed in general and in pop culture, that it's not viewed that way. I don't think that Whitney's life or death is dealt with as it should be at all. And you can believe that I'm making it my business to change that.
Yeah. Yeah. The essay you wrote about this performance, it's just seared onto my brain, and it has been for years. It's poetry to me. And the last, like, two or three graphs or so, you really just capture the beauty and the significance and the imagery of Whitney and that moment where she becomes transcendent, literally singing to the sky with war jets flying overhead. And I would love, if you're okay with it, for you to read the last part of that essay for our listeners.
Okay, I'm happy to. It makes me feel good too. Very emotional to write this part of the piece. Here we go. Most singers want out of that song. Most reach awkwardly for one note or another, or miss it altogether. It's not just that the song is a difficult one. It's difficult in front of people who want to feel the pride in the storybook words. They want to wave their ball caps and whoop in the pause after "or the land of the free." They want to be landlords in the home of the brave. Whitney's version made it all absolute for a moment. Her arms were wide and reaching slightly up at the end, a pose familiar to many Americans across races. Her head was back, as one's can be when victorious, and as one's can be when asking for and ecstatically receiving the glory of God. Bright bulbs flashed and popped off behind her. Floodlights intersected with the hazy Florida sunshine and created stairways to heaven. You could almost walk up there to where the four war jets are. You have to understand.
I miss her so much.
Isn't
I miss her so much?
Like, it's too much.
Yeah. Thanks again to author Danielle Smith. She's also the host of a podcast called Black Girl Songbook. You can find that wherever you get your podcasts. That show, Black Girl Songbook, it also has an episode dedicated to Whitney Houston. So go check it out. All right, this episode of It's Been a Minute was originally produced by Anjali Sastry, and additional production was done by Liam McBain. It was edited by Jordana Hochman. All right, listeners, enjoy your weekends and the new year. We're back in your feeds next week. Till then, be good to yourselves. I'm Sam Sanders. We'll talk soon.
Okay, close your eyes for a second. Now imagine you're on your dream vacation. No work calls to answer, no text messages to respond to, just your suitcase and an opportunity.
The opportunity to just take yourself out of your routine and travel deeper.
How to actually take that dream trip. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
On the TED Radio Hour, researcher Sasha Lucioni says AI can help us find climate solutions. But just training the technology itself uses a ton of energy.
Training ChatGPT, for instance, emits as much carbon as 5 cars in their lifetime.
Tech's climate conundrum. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
When the economic news gets to be a bit much,
listen to The Indicator from Planet Money. We're here for you, like your friends, trying to figure out all the most confusing parts. One story, one idea, every day, all in 10 minutes or less.
The Indicator from Planet Money, your friendly economic sidekick.
From NPR.